37, you know, and you were in the meeting, it meant you thought we had a little sense. We appreciated your presence. You carried a little weight. And I'm putting pressure on the next generation. I want to talk just briefly about the importance of culture and paying attention to the fact that black people generate commodity for selling culture. And they have decided already for this century that the freedom songs are going to be commercial commodity. And the interesting thing about the few projects I've run into is they tend to feature commercially released recordings by artists who were moved by the movement and wrote out of being moved. And when I talked to these people about it, and I said, you know, the music in the movement was on the street, in the mass meeting, in jail, and usually not solo. And I'm not having a problem with soloists. But I have a problem if you give me 10 songs and all of them are solo songs and you're telling me it's the music of the movement. It is equivalent to going to a program at the Smithsonian about the 60s as American protest music, and I'm going there and it's all about the struggle against the Vietnam War. And I'm sitting there, and ain't nobody up there on the stage. Ain't nobody, all the people on the stage are the anti-war fierce warriors, right? I'm going, how in the hell have you turned the 60s into the anti, how did you do that? They said, well, the civil rights movement is sort of a 50s thing. And I'm saying, where was Greensboro? Where was Nashville? What are you talking about? It is a dangerous thing when your radicals need to put you under the porch. And it is an absolute strand I see. And if you don't know better, you'll buy it, because the folklorists, the anthropologists, the ethnomusicologists, the cultural historians talked about spirituals, and they said spirituals were about us singing and praying and hoping that we would go to heaven when we die. And they were not protest songs. Then a certain group of them from this state got together and took some lyrics of spirituals with some lyrics of white camp meeting songs, picked the little words that were similar and used it as proof that the spirituals had come from the camp meeting songs. And when a black scholar, William Willis Lawrence James, took some white songs and said they came from spirituals, he could not get published until after he died. And he went to a very progressive publisher in New York who said it was too black chauvinistic. And I'm saying, as we move forward in the future, there is a very important work to be done about our cultural history, because it actually holds the analytical analysis of our people for our survival. If you are in a situation you can't change and you run sound through your body, you actually can get to the next day. I told that to a group of high school students. They were from New York, Ohio, Chicago, two schools in California. And when I talked about that scenario of living a life in a place where you can't change where you are right now. The Underground Railroad is not running today. And I said, when you hear bombing Gilead, that is the source and the use and the function of that song. I looked in the eyes of those students, and I was looking at students who operate in a terrorized reality. They do not know when they leave their house if they're going to get to school. They don't know when they get up in the class to go to the bathroom if it's going to be okay. They understood so much of what I was saying when I talked about the song. It is very important to understand freedom songs, because many of us didn't understand the freedom songs as resistance songs until they locked us up in jail, and those were the songs that we sang, flipping only a word here and there to make it totally contemporary, and especially not realigning the structure of the song, and the statement was contemporary. It was the same system, it was the same urgency, it was actually serving a new situation. And people say they sang.
Good morning, dear friends. I'm so sorry to have to cut this program off, but we do need to get to the rest of our morning news and public affairs block. Again, you can hear the rest, that entire program, at sotrueradio.org. And you may have heard the host saying over the break, they have a page on SoundCloud. Check them out there as well if you wish. Meanwhile, we're going to get you as much as we possibly can of Pacific Underground right here on KBOO Portland. And right after, I remind you that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and the support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com.
Hey, what's up, everyone? You are tuned into Pacific Underground. I'm one of your hosts this morning, Jenny Yokoyama, and I'm joined with fellow Pacific Underground producer Sarah Onitsuka. Last week, we interviewed the author Duncan Duncan Williams about his latest book, American Sutra, a story of faith and freedom in the Second World War. American Sutra is a book that explores Japanese Americans and their faith during World War II. And you know, a lot of times when people talk about Japanese Americans in World War II, they often talk about the obvious racist over undertones, all tones, we'll just call it all tones, when it came to the incarceration of Japanese Americans as an entire group of people. But something that's often left out of the discussion is about the villainization of Buddhism and Shintoism, the religions that the Japanese came over with when they were originally immigrating in the early 1900s and turn of the century back then. Even in my own family and in the Japanese American community that I directly grew up with, we rarely talked about the role of faith and the targeting of Japanese Americans. For example, it was very common knowledge and it was commonplace to see Buddhist ministers, well, Japanese Buddhist ministers, being taken away and questioned and imprisoned by the FBI, but we didn't see Christian ministers being treated the same way. So we're going to start off the interview with Sarah asking a question to author Duncan Duncan Williams.
So I heard that, well, so there's been a lot of books written about Japanese Americans during World War II and the concentration camps here, but there hasn't been one written about the Buddhist experience. Is that correct?
That's right. And I think this is the first book-length work with that particular frame of looking at Buddhism, and both as a kind of factor in why the incarceration and internment. I think we usually think about that experience as to why the Japanese and the Japanese American community were targeted in a way that the Italian and German American community were not. the Jack experience of mass incarceration. So we usually, I think, say, well, race and national origin explain that difference. And the argument in my book is that it's not just race, but race where it coincides with religion, given that about, you know, nearly 120,000 persons of ancestry, two-thirds of whom were, you know, American citizens, but over two-thirds of whom were Buddhists, ended up being the target of incarceration program. And so part of the book is about, like, why religion matters, or how does it fit into the picture of why the incarceration happened in the first place. And the flip side, or the heart of the book, is really about, so once experienced dislocation and loss, and, you know, in a state of uncertain situation in these camps behind barbed wire, people in that kind of situation often turn to something to help orient themselves. And for the vast majority of Japanese Americans in the camps who happen to be Buddhist, they turn to their Buddhist faith and their practice and community to help survive those years.
Right. So Buddhism almost made them doubly or triply or, you know, intersectionally un-American.
Right. And, you know, I think we have these discussions these days in our current times with, you know, let's just take, for example, the travel ban. We know that, you know, mass beneath the executive order, in the same way that the World War II executive order that led to the incarceration and internment, the executive order 9066 at that time, it didn't have any language about Japan or Japanese Americans in the executive order itself, but the intended target of that executive order was clear, and only the Japanese American community experienced mass incarceration. And in the same way, I think we could say that the executive order under the current administration, talking about a travel ban for certain countries, it was very clear that it was masking the intended community, which was majority Muslim nations, as part of what then-candidate Trump was talking about in terms of a total shutdown of Muslims coming into the United States. And so what is, to me, kind of clear is that on the one hand, there's a kind of animus around religion and Islamophobia in this country right now that targets faiths of Muslim heritage background in terms of coming into the country, as well as once in the country, even, you know, these questions about national citizenship and so forth. But the I think if we dig beneath the surface of animus against religion, we can also find that it's also animus around race. And so with the Muslim travel ban. And I should say the flip is true for what happened during World War II, that it looks on the surface it's about race. We, again, scratch beneath the surface, and we also see also animus around a non-Christian religion. All kind of based on the idea that some hold, perhaps even today, certainly was held by the general public, the media, and the United States government and intelligence service at that time, that America was fundamentally a white Christian nation. And so those who didn't quite fit into those categories, I think, as you said, had a doubly or kind of like an exclusion of a double kind.
For our listeners who may be unfamiliar with what that, say, the lived experience of that animus was, do you have any stories that maybe stuck out or examples of how that played out for American Buddhists?
Sure. You know, obviously, just right after Pearl Harbor, kind of like right what happened right after 9/11, religious houses of worship are certainly targeted. People would take, like, the Fresno Buddhist temple was shot at The Pahala Temple in Hawaii was, became victim of incident. People would, shoot at, throw things at these Buddhist temples, and I think Buddhism became this kind of representation of what was foreign and also what was the enemy. And I think particularly confusing to people at that time, the symbol for a Buddhist temple in Japanese is called a manji, and it's kind of like a reverse swastika, and so I think people conflated that kind of symbol with like the Japanese and like Nazis and like the enemy, and so Buddhist temples kind of became the target of that kind of animus, shall we say, sometimes even violent form. But more generally, I think you could say at that time, questions about immigration, questions about who belongs. These are things that it wasn't just about what happened right after, but in the decades prior to the war, starting with as far back, in fact, as the late 19th century with the Chinese Exclusion Act, where the exclusion or the idea that a people, people from a certain country was, unable to assimilate into the American fabric, not only because of their race, but also because of their religion. And at that time, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was being debated in Congress, the term heathen Chini, it was kind of a derogatory slur at that time to refer to the Chinese as being both racially immobile, but also heathens or non-Christians who should be banned from the country. So that kind of idea or rhetoric and talking about Buddhists, whether it's Japanese, persons of Japanese heritage or others, was happening in the decades prior to World War II as well.
So if I'm correct, your book is not only about how, the U.S. government tried to strip people of their belongings and culture and religion, but also about the resilience of the people. In the camps, how did people retain that religion and I guess the culture along with it?
So I think one of the things that we might recall is that people, once the executive order was issued and some notices started going up in a particular neighborhood, you'd be informed, you'd have literally between a week and maybe 10 days to report to one of these assemblies before you get transferred to these long-term camps run by War Relocation Authority. And so in that time, you could only take, what you could carry. So for most people, that meant a suitcase. So you'd have to search your house to figure out what you could take, what you would need the most to survive a future that you really had no idea what it was going to be like. And so in those situations, many people look to, like, if they had a baby, it would be a, milk bottle, or if he, some clothes, some sheet, they often were, for example, to pack their Buddhist altars or Buddhist, they call them wojuzu, or like rosaries and things like that. And so what would happen is that once you got to these camps in the interior of the United States, many of them in the desert, some of them in the swamp of Arkansas, what they would do is they wanted to you know, look to their faith and look to their Buddhist practice as a way to help them negotiate and navigate this really difficult situation. They didn't have any of the things. They couldn't bring that in their suitcase. And so they would go into the desert, find like dead wood or crates from the mess hall, and they would just try to, you know, it's a national thing, but like they would just try to make a Buddhist altar out of what was available. They would use peach pits. They had rationed fruit at that time, and so some people kept, for example, the peach pits of these pieces of fruit so that they could enough to make a rosary of some kind so that they could use it to chant their mantras. And so there are a lot of different things that people did that were quite creative, including, for example, in one camp, they wanted to celebrate the Buddha's birthday. It's one of the big festivals that one has in the Buddhist calendar. It was a good moment to, this is in the spring of 1990, the first time to try to get a big ceremony together. In one of the camps, they found a large carrot mess hall, and one of their fellow internees who was good at carving managed to carve a Buddha statue out of it. And usually in those ceremonies, you pour sweet tea on top of the statue of baby Buddha as a ritual celebration of birth of the Buddha, but also the birth of the religion of Buddhism. And so because they didn't have sweet tea, they got their army issued rationed sugar and coffee, and together they put that together and made some coffee. So there was a ceremony. It was a Buddhist birthday ceremony in the camp. They had this Buddha statue made of a carrot and this sweet coffee that they poured over it as the, you know, a way to kind of replicate and maintain and persist in their Buddhism. But you know, needing to work with what was there.
And how free were people to worship within the camp? They're in these concentration camps, and are they allowed to have temples or designated places of worship that were allowed by the government?
So initially, in the so-called assembly centers, as the big camps are being built, those camps are controlled by the U.S. Army, and the removal of the 110,000 person Japanese ancestry from the West Coast was run by the U.S. Army. They had very strict rules. For example, they banned any kind of gathering of more than three or four people if a Japanese language were to be used. I guess they were concerned about subversion or, you know, plots, and I'm not sure, but they had a very strict rule about that. They will view as contraband anything with Japanese, they call it kanji, or a Japanese writing in it. And and most Buddhist temples of war, many of the services either were in Japanese or dual, like English and Japanese. And so suddenly Buddhists were banned from having any sutras or Buddhist texts, scriptures, any book actually in Japanese. And the only exception the army made was they said a dictionary that has Japanese writing in it so then you can learn English, that's acceptable. And the Christian Bible, as translated into Japanese, that's acceptable. So just with that, you can see this policy that was disinclined or discouraging this from gathering and encouraging what we might call Anglo-Protestant normativity, this idea, you know, not only in the literal sense, but also in the idea of adopting English as the only language that shows you're American, and converting to Christianity as the main way to show loyalty to America. That was the kind of initial policy in these assembly centers. And once it got to the WRA, Warren Location Authority Camps. It's an agency that was a civilian agency. So they had a little bit different point of view, which was that, you know, at that time, during World War II, as troop levels were increasing in North Africa, in Italy, in campaign, you know, against the Nazis, fascists, that it was very clear that President Roosevelt had issued the basic idea behind the war, which was America was fighting for what he called the four freedoms. And this idea that America was this kind of free nation, including one of the four items, was freedom of religion. So it was too much of a contradiction to have not only taken all these people, including, as I said, two-thirds of whom were American citizens, who, you know, you constitutionally, under due process, you usually need to have a trial to convict somebody before you put them behind a prison wall. And so they had already done that. Then to further deny them religious freedom seemed perhaps a step too far. And so the WRA, Location Authority, ultimately decided was that they would provide one, what they call barrack church, it's like a barrack in the middle of the camp, and they would dedicate one for the Protestants, one for the Catholic, one for the Buddhists. And so ultimately it came to that despite the initial discipline and discouragement of Buddhists being able to gather behind barbed wire, because the majority of the community were Buddhists, these barrack churches became not only a hub for spiritual and religious guidance, but also a kind of community hub, a social hub, where young people, elderly people, women's associations, lots of different type of groups started to meet at the so-called Buddhist church or Buddhist temple in Siam.
You're listening to Pacific Underground, coming to you from the studios of KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. If you're just tuning in, what you're listening to is an interview with author Duncan Duken Williams. We're talking about his latest book, American Sutra, A Story of Faith and Freedom in the Second World War. You know, I really appreciate this book coming out, especially this week, the week that includes the Day of Remembrance, which is February 19th, and it marks the anniversary of the signing of Executive Order 9066, the executive order that President Roosevelt signed back during World War II, and is the order that eventually led to the mass incarceration of over 100,000 Japanese Americans. What often gets lost sometimes during the telling of this event is the loss of personal stories or the humanization, the complex nature of what it was to be incarcerated. So this book by Duncan Duken Williams explores faith and the role of faith for Japanese Americans during this very hard time of struggle for them. So let's get back to the interview. Again, here's Sarah talking to Duncan Duken Williams.
So after the war, how did Japanese Americans rebuild their Buddhist communities? I mean, do you think their pre-camp and post-camp Buddhisms were different?
No, I think with say generally with the Buddhist tradition as a whole, when you know Buddhism moved from India to China, it became, they call Sennified, so it became more Chinese, interacting with the Buddhism, and I was in one of the pre-existing religious traditions, cultural traditions existed there. It moved from China to Japan, and every time it moves, there is a process of let's call it acculturation. And so, as Buddhism had come with these immigrants as far back as 1868 to Hawaii, and then onto the continental United States, there already was a process of you know, Americanization or acculturation to the American cultural and religious landscape. But what happened was that in camp, those years, I think probably accelerated and crystallized something called American Buddhism at a fast, you know, a vastly quicker rate than would have done if Americans had not been put behind barbed wire. And so things like English language sermons, English language sutra study and discussion groups, the activation of the American-born, the, you know, called the Nisei or the second-generation U.S. citizen members of the community step into formal leadership roles in the Buddhist organizations. All of these things hastened, I think, because of camp. And so by the time, your question was also about by the time they got out, how did we build their vicinities? Certainly one thing changed was this kind of regional change, where the American-born second generation took leadership of Buddhist temples and organizations and associations. But also the big change was that before the war, Japanese American community was primarily, you know, other than in, for example, rural or Washington and California, in the cities, they had these Japan towns or these kind of ethnic enclaves where people tended to be concentrated. And I think there was a major dispersal out of Japan. These, I mean, you know, today in the year 2019, there are only three left in San Jose, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and all of them are getting smaller as time goes on. But so I think after the war, the kind of dispersal and deconcentration of Japanese Americans, this affected, you know, every kind of Japanese American community organization, including the temple. But also the other thing was that people also moved east to Chicago, to Cleveland, to New York, places out east of the Rocky Mountains, south beyond the Defense Command Zone, in the so-called free zone regions of the country. And so I think the older styles of these Japan towns and things of these Buddhist temple community hubs began to dissipate because of that disbursement east, as well as the, in essence, kind of the disappearance of Japan up and down the West Coast.
So you've been referring to the Buddhism of Japanese Americans as American Buddhism, and I was just curious, mm-hmm. because I've always heard in America there's this dichotomy between Western Buddhism, which is sort of typically white folks who have adopted Buddhism for themselves, versus cultural Buddhism, right. which is more what we're thinking of maybe Japanese Americans or other cultural groups who have taken Buddhism, you know, from their home countries. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that distinction and why you refer to it in your book as American Buddhism.
Well, you know, I've always been slightly irked by the idea that only Buddhism only becomes American if white people do it. You know what I mean? And the idea that, you know, that white Americans who converted to Buddhism in the 1960s and 70s and the cultural movement, that's the beginning point of American Buddhism. That's always been a very annoying kind of position to me, given that Buddhism has, through the migration of many different Asian communities into Hawaii, into the West Coast and elsewhere, been a part of the American landscape for, you know, well over 100 years. Many of the temples in Hawaii, many of the temples in San Francisco and LA are over 100 years old, and why are they not considered American Buddhism? It's always been a very, it never made any sense to me. It's as if the word American can only be attached to white people, and Asian Americans or other Americans who come from other regions of the world are either forever friends or second-class Americans. And so I've resisted that type of characterization of Asian Americanism or Japanese Americanism that I take up in the book, and I just like to call it Americanism, because these are people that have struggled, despite even before the war, certainly during the war, being told they belong. Welcome to consider yourself an equal American to a person that happens to be Christian, that happens from Europe, that are racially white. And so I've always been insisting that why would we not call these people that have been here for over 100 years, American Buddhists?
So I guess as we're approaching the end of the interview here, I know that your book came out very recently, but I'm curious about the responses. Have there been any particularly meaningful responses that you want to share?
I think earlier in the interview I mentioned that it took 17 years, and it wouldn't have been possible with the assistance of many members of the American community. And I've had different kinds of kind endorsements by like Chikei, who's a member of the Japanese American Buddhist community, and Viet Tam Nguyen, and a lot of different people. I think for me, in terms of the response to the book that's been most meaningful and heartfelt, are some of the people I interviewed along the way, in their 90s now, and I was able to send them copies of the book, and I've been getting emails from them saying, thank you for telling my family story or my community story, and those type of responses where they might point to an anecdote story in the book that hit them as resonating with what they actually went through. As I said, there are so few people left now who were, there are some people who were, babies or born in who are still quite, not too elderly and quite active, but people who were a little bit older, who were at that time quite aware of what was going on, they're passing away very unfortunately year by year, so that we almost are at a time when those people's voices and firsthand knowledge is disappearing. And so for me to have received a few emails of that kind from people who are in their 90s, who kindly, patiently read the book after all these years, that's been, to me, the most meaningful.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just want to say, as a Yonsei, with all three of my four grandparents who were in the camps, the three of them who were in the camps have all passed away already, and there's kind of a lot of regret for me in not asking them about their time there. And so I really appreciate you telling this story that hasn't been told before.
Well, thank you very much. I really hope that it, contributes something. There is a lot of literature starting to come out, and different people trying to tell a story in different ways. I'm starting to go on the road with this book, and there are musicians like Kishibashi or No No Boy or other groups that I'm sharing the stage with, friends of mine, and they're trying to do their work in terms of music, and other people doing it in terms of oral history collecting, and other people doing it, you know, with a film and short documentaries. But it is that era where we need to capture these stories as much and just to, you know, deliver these, I think, very compelling stories of that past that helps us really kind of get a grip on also where we are as a country today. To me, it's like thinking about Buddhism back then and compared to, you know, today you have like mindfulness Google, and you've got, you know, Sandra Oh hosting the Golden Globes, or Senator Mazie Hirono, the first Buddhist elected to Congress, grilling Supreme Court nominees. It seems so much more like we're at a time where it's okay to be Buddhist and even, like, you know, Asian and Buddhist at the same time. But it wasn't that long ago where this was not the case. And so I'm trying to give that particular angle to it. But other people also doing really, really good work about life in camp in all of its complexity. And so, I just appreciate being part of the conversation with you and with other people.
We still got a couple minutes here, so I'm going to fangirl. This is Jenna. I'm going to fangirl here, too, about how much I appreciate this book, because unlike Sarah, I did speak to some of my grandparents who went to the camps, and that's why when this book came out, I just sort of kind of had to just knock myself over the head and think to myself, wow, why didn't I even think of these things? My family was pretty tight-lipped about their experience in the camps, but it never really dawned on me to ask about what it looked like, what the temples looked like. In your book, you do have several historical photos of places that I've been to before, and it just sort of shocked me to see the photos, and it also shocked me that I hadn't really ever thought about what attacks on a community would look like, and it really sort of painted a picture for me that was more complete than what my family was willing to talk about, because I feel like Olnike kind of know that when it comes to this part of our history, it often is a closed off part of the history to especially younger people who are maybe the Yonsei and didn't, you know, get to know a lot of their family members. And so I really appreciate you just talking about the little parts of people's everyday lives and how faith worked for them in their lives, whether it comes to Buddhism or whether they were Christian, because that's a large part of your discussion too, is these Christian Japanese and Buddhist Japanese having to come together, and when they did and when they didn't. And it's just added such a level of complexity and just humanness to the story that I hadn't thought, and that also allows some relatability for myself as someone who still belongs to an older sect of Japanese Buddhism, having come up through my family. So I really appreciate you just opening these questions and this discussion in general, because it really humanizes the story.
Well, thank you for reading the book and having it resonate with you in that way and open up these questions. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Duncan, for joining us on Pacific Underground today. We really appreciate all the work that you're doing, and, you know, just like you were mentioning, we had No No Boy just here, what was it, a couple months ago, and really appreciate everyone who is continuing to tell the story and re-explore the story that is such a personal history for many of us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate being with you today.
Okay, so that was a super interesting interview. Something, if our listeners don't know, both of us are Yonsei, meaning we both had grandparents and maybe great-grandparents who went to the concentration camps during World War II. And something we were talking about a little bit off-air was just about how these were just not questions that we spoke to our families about, because we hadn't really thought about it. And I was thinking about how the only time I remember talking about faith was in terms of World War II was when I was doing my history project, because that's when I first started like exploring my family's history. Like when I was in, I think I was like in seventh grade, and you had to do like the history project. And of course, I was like, I'll interview my grandparents, not realizing how that's like pulling teeth in mm-hmm. Japanese American family mm-hmm. to ask about that history. But I remember doing research, and the only thing that my grandparents also remembered was that like all the Buddhist priests were rounded up by the FBI and like all disappeared into like camps, especially like the top priests, right? And so like that was, I don't know why, even then as an adult, as I explored these things, that didn't lead to like more questions of like, well, what about the Christian ministers? Like, you know, as the author's pointing out, you know, we'd like to think, oh, it's just because you're Japanese, but the Christian ministers were not rounded up in the same way. And I had never even like explored that thought.
Right, because it's like Eastern propaganda or something, right?
Yeah.
The Buddhist texts. Yeah, I mean, like I said in the interview, I wasn't able to speak to the grandparents, my grandparents who were in the camps at all. But even with my own exploration outside of that, just reading books and things like that, like religion never came up for me. It wasn't something that I thought about too much, and maybe it's because it's not a huge thing, you know, in my life. Mm-hmm. But thinking about how obviously religion could totally be something that keeps people grounded or that keeps people going through a tough time like that, and just it's astonishing to me that I didn't even really think about it.
Yeah, I mean, especially like, yeah, it's like these days and age, maybe it's because we're like not such a generation that goes to like church a lot compared mm-hmm. to like our grandparents. Like, okay, like I go to temple, I do not go every Sunday. And I remember my great grandmothers, they could chant the sutras like from memory.
Wow.
And I am someone who's just like flipping through the book, like, where are we? I don't even know which one we're doing, you know? So like their faith was deep and real. And I think sometimes, yeah, that conversation with myself gets lost. And then something else I wish I could go back and ask my great grandparents was like, how did your faith feel to you individually, mm-hmm. like before you went into camp, while you were in camp, and then when you came out? Because something that also I don't often think of is like how many people died in the concentration camps, and like how many people got married or how many people had babies. Like life still happened inside the camps, and you still, you know, we still traditionally have like religious people oversee these like stages of life, and those things were still happening. And like what that was to allow them to practice that or not practice that. One story I've heard recently is about how one woman who went to the camp, she remembered how, as he was talking about, like there was the barrack where you could like worship. Mm-hmm. Well, it was shared by like everybody. And we call it American Buddhism, but you know, in Japan, there's how many different sects of Buddhism, and that all came to the United States. And so she remembered that every week a different minister would do their thing. So they would have Buddhist service, but one week it would be like Jodo Shinshu, and the next week it might be Zen, and then the next week it might be Shingo. And like, it's like, oh wow, that's something you would have never had within the community. And then all of a sudden everybody's kind of coming together. And that was something she had kind of thought was a unique thing about camp, was that it created this overlapping of communities that maybe wouldn't have.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
I was so surprised when he said that Buddhism was almost accelerated in the camps.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to me because, you know, when you're forced into those conditions, obviously you might rely on your faith more.
Yeah.
And you're all in the same close quarters. And so I guess it makes sense, but that's also something that I wouldn't have necessarily guessed.
And something else I like wish I could go back and ask, especially like people who were like resisting, you know, these arrests and all the racism and everything, is, you know, that acceleration, like, did you feel even maybe more drawn to something maybe that you were like loosely kind of affiliated with? Because definitely for people who don't know, like Japanese culture is really tightly entwined with Buddhism, you know? So like, even if you're not strictly Buddhist, you're probably practicing some Buddhist things just by culture. And so, you know, when people are trying to take away Buddhism from the community in general, it's trying to strip a part of the culture, because like, this is just me talking for my own rebelliousness, is that if someone's like, well, we're going to take away Buddhism, I'd be like, well, no, yeah, no.
That's mine. Don't
that's
take
mine.
It away.
I'm yeah, more Buddhist exactly. than ever. I got
exactly.
the faith. You know?
Yeah.
And so like that, that acceleration. And I mean, you know, and then something else in the book that we didn't really get to talk about with him that I hadn't even thought about was, spoiler alerts, if you're all out to read the book, American Sutra, is about the purpose of the temples after people got out, because so many people were homeless and like houseless, mm-hmm. you know, they had nothing. And so that all these temples along the West Coast served as hostels mm-hmm. for many people for a long time. So they were just places of refuge until people yeah. could figure out where to go. So they really did serve as like a more than just a religious center.
And I like I liked the comparisons that he was drawing to current day issues as mm-hmm. well. Current day situations, like you know, places of faith these days can also be used as places of refuge for people, and they have been mm-hmm. across various religions.
Yeah,
so we're seeing those parallels, and this, you know, history tends to kind of repeat itself like that yeah. if we don't listen or like look back at it.
Exactly, like that's why people need to keep telling the stories. It's not just to keep a story alive, but to we can always see the parallel of this mm-hmm. is still it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's honestly heartbreaking to read that book and just be like, oh, well, all this just sounds like today. This all could
right.
so easily happen. And it's so easy to see how the like oppression of religion and seeing it as something pagan, it, like literally that was a word that was used by like Americans, was
pagan.
That's a pagan
yeah.
religion, you know, and exoticizing it in such a negative way leads to possibly the mass incarceration of people mm-hmm. and like the stripping of human rights. So
right.
really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing this interview with me, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Pacific Underground. That was an interview with author Duncan Dukin Williams about his book, American Sutra, A Story of Faith and Freedom in the Second World War. If you want to learn more about the book, you can find him on the socials at American Sutra. Or you can also learn more about the author at his website, DuncanDukinWilliams.com. If you're in Portland and you're looking for something local to learn more about Japanese-American incarceration during World War II, this weekend there's actually a documentary screening of For the Sake of the Children. The documentary will be talking about the Executive Order 9066, as well as executive orders today and how that's still impacting humanity. So that screening here in Portland is going to be happening this Sunday, February 24th at 2 p.m. at Portland State University at Hoffman Hall. For more information, you can find it on the socials. You can also go to their website at forthesakeofthechildren.org. And I'm going to climb back up on my pedestal here and just remind everybody that we're not talking necessarily about something that's historical. While it's great to go back and to talk about my own history, the whole point of having interviews like this is to constantly remind us that this story, the story of the Japanese Americans, is not unique. And it's a story that continues over and over and over again for various groups of people here in the United States. So yes, learn about our history, but also realize that, unfortunately, history continues to repeat. Reach out to your neighbors, see what you can do to help, understand their struggle, because literally, it takes people like you and me, the ones who aren't currently being oppressed, to speak up, to stop this from happening again. Thank you very much, again, to Duncan Dukin Williams for speaking with us today, and thank you very much to Sarah Onitsuka for joining me for that interview. So to take us out for the rest of this episode, we're going to have a couple songs by two different bands that include Japanese Americans talking about their struggle. So the first song that we're going to hear is Instructions to All Persons by the group Nono Boy, a duo that's currently touring the United States, and they're just bringing out all this great music. We've talked about them here in Pacific Underground before. I really like this song because it takes its text from the instructions that were left to Japanese Americans when it came to being quote-unquote evacuated from their homes.
Instructions to all persons of Japanese instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. I think of my friend Sachi, now Mrs. Kuwatani, telling me stories in the old folks' home. Like the time she was a little girl, climbed above the rest of the world, scaled the tower at the Santa Anita racetrack. We're not even the boys that go, and she felt good for a moment or so. Friend Todd, fishing scorpions from the heart, Colorado River, Indian land, would-be Casanova, walking three girls home from the dance. Well, after me. Singing harmony, till one by one they'd leave and leave Tots strung back in the moonlight. Singing ballads to the stars on his own, and he felt good. Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons.
That was Instructions to All Persons by the duo Nono Boy. And I know I said that last song was the one that was going to take us out, but we have a little bit of time left here in our hour, so I want to sneak in another favorite band of mine that has Japanese Americans talking about their struggle. The song Yellow Pearl by the band Yellow Pearl from their 1970s album A Grain of Sand. Music for the Struggle by Asians in America. It's an album that came out during the Asian American movement. It's iconic. It's in the Smithsonian. Do all the Googles. Learn about it. Because it's a really powerful album. Again, you're listening to Pacific Underground. Thank you so much for joining me today. Don't forget to look up Pacific Underground on the socials at PAC Underground. And you can always find all of our archived audio on iTunes and at KBOO's website, kboo.fm. And don't forget to tune in for our next show, which is next Friday at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for tuning in as always.
A grain, a tiny grain of sand, landing in the belly. In the belly of the monster. And time is telling only how long it takes, layer after layer, as its beauty unfolds, until its captor it holds in peril. A grain, a tiny grain of sand.
In the ocean oyster beds, posed beneath the sea. Open one and you might find, deep in one of different mind, one who looks like me.
the Senate chamber rang, victory was the call. Defeat invaders from the north, but they weren't beat at all. And I am a yellow pearl, and you are a yellow pearl, and we are the yellow pearl, and we are half the world, and we are half the world. Now you might say I'm just a dreamer, like you just don't appear, and I refuse to grant you, schemer, recognition that you're here. Now you can say just what you want, but my hurt has ceased, 'cause I see signs of myself come drifting in from the east.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd at the Milagro Theater in Portland. La Segua is a Central American cautionary folktale of a young, beautiful woman whom philandering men encounter on their way back home. Her beauty decays into a horror that drives the men mad. The play tells the story of a beautiful woman who was haunted by the specter of La Segua and takes a hard look at Costa Rican values, including ambition, hypocrisy, and follows themes of machismo, vanity, and narcissism. Again, that's La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.